Greetings and welcome back to our study of the book of Shmuel. My name is Yitzchak Et Shalom, and today we are going to study the fifth chapter of Shmuel Aleph, Perek Hey, which, as you can see, if you have the text in front of you, is an extremely short chapter, but it is filled with very significant things that we will use as an opportunity to discuss some general issues relating to our study of the Tanakh, and two overriding, one of what we may call agenda, and the other of issues relating to the text and textual variations, as it were. Let's first read through the Perek, to give a little background to it. In Perek Dalet, in the last chapter, the Aron, which had been brought out to battle from Shiloh, was taken captive and was taken by the Plishtim. In the epilogue of the chapter, we read about the death of Eli and the death of Hophni Finchas, and then the death of Mrs. Pinchas as she gave birth to Ichavod, her son who she gave that very unpleasant name to. And we mentioned at the end the possible correlations and associations with the story of Rachel and the death of Rachel and the birth of Binyamin. And now we continue with Perek Hey. Uflishtim lakchu et Aron ha'Elohim, vayvihu me'evan ha'ezer ashdoda. So the Plishtim took the Aron. They undoubtedly took the Aron as something between a trophy and a mantic device, meaning they recognized that the Aron was special. They, of course, thought, as we saw in Perek Dalet, that the Aron was a manifestation of God, because they declared that God has come into the camp. And as I said, they got this clue from Bnei Yisrael, and Bnei Yisrael's errant attitude towards the Aron, one which we will finally see repaired in Perek Zion. And they brought the Aron from Evan HaEzer, which here is used very ironically and somewhat sardonically, the notion that this was a rock where Hashem was going to help them, and of course nothing of the sort happened, and they brought it to Ashdod. Why did they bring it to Ashdod? So let's back up a little bit. If we read in Yehoshua Perek Yud Aleph, which those of you studying with the OU.org Nach Yomi program remember from about a month ago, in the 11th chapter of Sefer Yehoshua, we read about the five Sarnei Plishtim, the five captains of the Plishtim. So just a little bit about the Plishtim, as I promised in yesterday's podcast. The Plishtim were sea people who had arrived from the Grecian islands, but they came in at least two different waves. And we see that from several differences between the Plishtim that we meet in Sefer Bereshit and the Plishtim that we meet in Sefer Shoftim and Shmuel. The Plishtim that we meet in Sefer Bereshit are chiefly concentrated in an area called Gerar, which is somewhat inland, and it's somewhat further north than the cities that we're going to deal with. Besides which, they have a Melech, and a Melech with a titular name, Avimelech. As we see, it's a title name because in the next generation, the king is also called Avimelech. The Avimelech who deals with Avraham and the Avimelech who deals with Yitzchak, they're not the same person, but they have this same title name. They have a king. And the Plishtim that we meet in Sefer Yehoshua, which means the Plishtim who subsequently, while we were in Egypt, came as a second wave, as it were, of immigrants, settled in five major towns. Those are called the Chameshet Sarnei Plishtim, and we'll see much more about that in Perek Vav, but we'll see much of it here. And they settled in Ashdod, Ashkelon, Azah, Gat, and Ekron. The first three are towns that we're very familiar with, and the ancient town is not that far from the modern town of Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Azah, respectively. Gat is a town that's further inland and further north, and years ago was likely misidentified, and therefore the modern Israeli town of Kiryat Gat was established next to it. But Gat, Tel HaSufi, was recently identified with some level of certainty a little bit further inland than previously thought. And Ekron also is a town that we know pretty much where it is. And these five towns are called Arei Plishtim. They're also referred to as Sarnei Plishtim. Now, a Saren is a captain or a general. And what becomes clear is that these Plishtim, in this period, do not have a monarchy. Rather, they have some sort of a military alliance between the five groups, and each one of these towns is under the direction of a military leader. who then the outlying villages are considered to be associated with each of the towns which it's close to. So the Plishtim had a temple originally in the town of Aza. They had a temple of to their god Dagon, and we'll talk about Dagon in a minute. If you recall back in Sefer Shoftim, Shimshon destroyed that temple. They now have a temple to Dagon in the town of Ashdod. So, like Chuflishtim et Aron HaElohim, Vayaviru Oto Beit Dagon. They brought it to Beit Dagon, the house of Dagon. Vayatzigu Oto Etzel Dagon. They set the Aron next to Dagon. Now, remember, the Plishtim are sea people. And therefore, it should not surprise us that the deity they worship, or more likely, the form that they used to represent the deity that they worshipped, was shaped something like a fish, and therefore named Dagon, the fish god, as it were. And the Dagon image is set up in the Beit Dagon, and they brought the Aron to stand in front of it as a vanquished in front of the victor. Because the assumption is, if the Plishtim beat Israel, that means Dagon overpowered the God of Israel. That, of course, is why any military loss of Am Yisrael is directly a Chilul Hashem. Vayashkimu Ashdodim Mimochorat, and the Ashdodim got up the next morning, after seeing the after having placed the Aron in front of Dagon, and we don't know what they expected, but what they saw is not what they expected. Perhaps what they expected was to see the Aron lying prostrate in front of Dagon, or just to see things the way that they were yesterday. Vihine, an important note, parenthetic note, the word vihine in Tanakh always indicates some sort of a surprise. They came the next morning, vihine, surprise, Dagon nofel lefanav artsa. Dagon is falling in front of the Aron. So Dagon is prostrate in front of the Aron. Lifnei Aron Adonai. Vayikhu et Dagon vayashivu oto limkomo. Now, the people who were in the temple, whether the Kohanei Dagon, whoever they might be, took Dagon and they set him back up in its place. How would they interpret this? What was going through their minds when they did this? Did they say, uh-oh, we better cover up this thing because people might get the wrong idea, or people might get the right idea about the relationship between the Aron and Dagon? Or did they do what everybody pretty much does? When they see something which goes against the current of belief, they find some way to rationalize it. Oh, it was a mistake. It just an accident, a coincidence, and they set it upright. So they put Dagon back in its place. Vayashkimu vaboker, they got up the next morning, mocharat, v'nei Dagon nofel lefanav artsa. Same scene, Dagon has fallen in front of the Aron, fnei Aron Adonai, but it's worse for them. V'rosh Dagon u'shtei chapot yadav krutot al hamiftan. The head of Dagon, the head of the image, was cut off of the body, of the torso. And the two arms, and they were all lying on the threshold into the temple. Rak Dagon nishar alav. Only Dagon itself, meaning the torso, was still on its body. In other words, the whole thing had fallen over, and the head and two hands had rolled over or been brought over, and were sitting on the threshold. Now, the objective reader seeing this, who believes in the strength of all of these deities, and sees that Dagon has fallen 2 days in a row, and the second day with much more symbolic, and we'll talk about the symbolism in a minute, symbolic loss and devastation happening to him, and shaming, would come to the conclusion that the Aron is a greater god than Dagon. And then they would put the Aron on the pedestal, or they would go to Am Yisrael and say, teach us about your laws, as we find in Malachim Bet Yod Zayin, something of that sort. Instead, what do they do? Al kein lo yiduchu chohanei Dagon, v'chol abayim beit Dagon, al miftan Dagon, v'ashtod ader mazeh. Therefore, what happens? None of the priests of Dagon, and nobody comes into Beit Dagon, will ever walk on the threshold in Ashdod, until this very day. Now, until this very day indicates that at the time that Sefer Shmuel is completed, the Plishtim are still around, that the temple is still in Ashdod, and people are still worshiping there, and they still have this curious practice that nobody walks on the threshold. In other words, years later, when somebody will come up and say, why do we have this weird custom that whenever we walk into Beit Dagon, we step over the threshold, we never touch it, and the Kohanim are there to warn us not to touch it, or whatever may happen. So, oh, because years ago, this ark came from our neighbors, and when it came in, Dagon's head and arms were cut off and went and touched the Miftan. But think how ridiculous this is. It means that Dagon, instead of now being reviled because of his weakness in front of the Aron, has now sanctified more territory because his cut-off hands and head fell on the threshold. Now, at this point, this is really halfway through the Perek, even though it's less than half of the Psukim, is really part one of the Perek. And it's at this point that we need to take a break and talk about a particular style or agenda, if you will, of the text that courses through so much of Tanakh and is very manifest here. It is very clear that the text is highlighting the silliness and the emptiness and the vanity of the belief in Dagon, and highlighting how very vapid the belief is that the people, when they see that the Dagon is destroyed, instead of changing their minds or coming to an understanding of that this is just an idol, instead they end up sanctifying all the places that his cut-off head and hands went to. Parenthetically, the significance here is very strong in light of Tehillim Kuf Tef Dvav, and in light of Tehillim Kuf Lamed Hei, and in light of passages in Yechezkel about how the idols have hands but they cannot touch, and that they have ears and they cannot hear. So take a look here at how they have all the functions that are significant: eyes and mouth and nose and throat that are mentioned in that passage are cut off with the head, and the hands are cut off. Evidently, Dagon didn't have legs, because it's mentioned that Dagon's hands are cut off and all that's left is the torso. So it doesn't have legs. But there's another piece to this puzzle. If you think back to Sefer Shoftim in Perek Chet, at the end of Perek Zion, the Ephraimites go and chase down the two generals of the Midianim, Orev and Ze'ev, and they decapitate them and bring their heads to Gidon. Bringing the head to Gidon is a demonstration of ultimate vanquishing, ultimate victory over these people. Here are their heads as it were as a trophy. We find this later on, we'll see in Perek Yod Zayin, at the very end of Perek Yod Zayin, after David destroys Goliath, he cuts his head off and takes his head and ultimately ends up in Yerushalayim. That's piece one. Piece two is back to the Gidon story in Perek Chet, when Gidon comes with his people, and those of you who followed in Nach Online remember this from only a couple weeks ago. When Gidon followed the Midianim, and he with his army of a few hundred men, came through the town of Sukkot, and he said to the town of Sukkot, please give our army some food to eat, we're hungry, we're tired. They said, oh, do you have the hands of Zevach and Salmuna in your hands that we should feed you? In other words, another sign of vanquishing the enemy is to cut off the hands of the kings and show the hands. And given that sense, you see that the hands and the head of Dagon being cut off is an ultimate statement within the cultural milieu, is an ultimate statement of really being destroyed. And nonetheless, the response of the Kohanei Dagon is not to admit defeat, not to surrender, not to rethink their religious affiliation, if you will, which of course is a very modern concept, but rather to sanctify the place that it fell. Now, onto the issue of agenda. The Gemara in Masachet Megillah, towards the end, says, "Kol leitzanita asira, barmi leitzanita davorazara." You're not allowed to be silly or scornful and poke fun, except at avorazara. And the Gemara there quotes several examples of where Tanakh itself makes fun of avorazara. I'll give you an example that's not brought in the Gemara, just out of just for an interesting piece. Is that one of the most famous idolatrous cults, which is known in the Western world from Tanakh, is the cult of Baal Zebub, or as the Christians like to call him, Beelzebub. And in later Christian literature, it's associated with Lucifer, with Satan, etc. And that, of course, led to the very popular book that many of us read in high school, Lord of the Flies, a translation of Baal Zebub. However, Baal Zebub is not really the name of that deity. Nobody would worship the Lord of the Flies. The real name was Baal Zevul. Sounds alike. Baal Zevul means the Lord of the High Place. Zevul is a high place. You know, we say it in Sur Mishaloh all the time. Zevul Beit Tifartecha, right? Which is from Shlomo. Beit Zevul Baniti Lach in Melachim Aleph Perak Chet. And the real name of the god was Baal Zevul. But the Tanakh makes fun of it. And how does it make fun of it? It changes one little letter from Baal Zevul, the Lord of the High Place, to Baal Zevuv, the Lord of the Flies. And from there on, that's how it's known. Indeed, Lord of the Flies is a translation of a change, not of the real name of that god. Doesn't take anything away from the power of the book, but nonetheless, as far as the title is concerned. But there are numerous examples of where Tanakh will poke fun at idolatry to demonstrate the emptiness of it. One other example. Sarna brings this up in his book on Bereishit. Is that there was a cult in the in Mesopotamia that worshipped snakes. So it's not at all surprising that when the Torah presents the Yetzer Hara or the Malach HaMavet or the Satan, however you want to describe it in rabbinic terms, at the very beginning of Bereishit, who is tempting, who is evil, etc., that it's in the form of a snake. And there's so many other examples. One last example, just because it's so interesting and so prevalent in our awareness, is a very powerful story at the beginning of the 11th chapter of Bereishit, and that is the story of Migdal Shinar, commonly called Migdal Bavel. What does the text there tell us? That some men went from east, and they came to a valley in Shinar, and they said, this is a nice place, and let's build it, and we'll build a big tower, and we should not be scattered. What the issues are in that parsha is way beyond what we can talk about here. However, at the very end, what happens? HaKadosh Baruch Hu confounds their languages. God confounds their languages so they cannot hear each other. And the text ends with the phrase, Al Kain Kara Shem Ha'ir Bavel, Kisham Balal Adonai Sfat Kol Haaretz. Therefore, they called the name of the place Bavel. Listen very carefully to it. Bavel, because there God mixed up Balal, the language of all the land. Now, that's a little bit of a difficult explanation, because to say that the people who live there, and who live there till today, in other words, while Bereishit is being given at Har Sinai, or in Arvot Moav, there is a town called Bavel, and that town is a thriving town, a very important town, throughout much of history of Tanakh. And that to think that they named the town Bavel because that's where God confounded the languages, that's a little bit difficult. But what's much more difficult is that if you really wanted to name the town something after God mixing the languages, and the word is Balal, then call it Balal. Why call it Bavel? The answer is that the locals and the Sumerians who established the town did not call it Bavel because of God mixing up the languages. They had a whole different intent. Because in their language, Bavel is a conflation of the words Bab Elim. Bab, which means gate, right? We're familiar, Bavakama, Bab El Wad, depending what your frame of reference is. And Elim is Elohim. Bavel, Bab Elim, means the gate to the gods. And they indeed believed. And on their ziggurat, which was built in Bavel, they had written, this is the gate to the gods. They believed this was to paraphrase from Yaakov's statement, Shara Shamayim, this is the gateway to heaven. And so the Torah is making fun of it and saying, no, your gateway is not a gateway to heaven. Your gateway is a gateway to gibberish. It's not Bavel, Bab Elim, rather it's Bavel, Balal. It's a place of mixture. So the Torah, again, is poking fun at the idolatrous nations and at their and the very errant beliefs. And there's no question that this passage we're reading about the events of the Aron in the land of the Plishtim, and specifically in the Temple of Dagon, are a piece of this, and this type of literature is called polemic literature, from the Greek word polmos, which means battle, but it is a battle of words, and polemic literature is something which we're familiar with from a lot of different perspectives in Midrashic works and in later works, but it also exists very, very frequently in Tanakh, and this is a prime example. Tov, let's look at the second half of our chapter. Vatichbad yad Adonai el Hashdodim. God's hand was now very severe against the people in Ashdod. Vayishimem, and he destroyed them. Now, he made them desolate. How did that happen? Vayachotam, and now read carefully. The text reads, Ba'apolim. But the way we read it out loud is, Ba'tachorim. This is a phenomenon known as kriyuchtiv. When we finish the parak, we'll talk about kriyuchtiv. Et Ashdod vet kvuleha. We will read it as the kri, the way it's supposed to be read. Vayacho tam bat techorim et Ashdod vet kvuleha. So parenthetically, apolim very likely refers to the bubonic plague, and techorim is hemorrhoids. So the people in Ashdod and everybody around Ashdod, as I mentioned, each one of the towns had surrounding villages that were associated with it, were all struck by this plague. Vayuru anshei Ashdod kichein. The people in Ashdod saw this was happening. Vyamru, and they realized that this was because the Aron was there. Lo yeshev Aron Elohei Yisrael imanu. We don't want the Ark of the God of Israel to be dwelling among us. His hand has become very strong against us and against Dagon. Now, very interesting. Now they're protesting over the religious defilement of Dagon, but they didn't say that until they themselves got attacked. In other words, when Dagon was attacked, they put it back. But now, when they're getting attacked, they say, he's been acted strongly against us and also against Dagon. So what happened? They called all of the generals, which means the Seren of Ashkelon and the Seren of Ashdod, etc. Vayimru, mana sal Aron Elohei Yisrael. So what should we do with this Aron? We can't keep it here. It's destroying us. Do we send it back to Am Yisrael, thus indicating some sort of surrender? Vayimru, Gat Yisov. Send it to Gat. Gat is another one of the cities of Plishtim. Now, why would sending it to Gat be any better? So the thinking may have been that the Aron is only powerful in the vicinity of Dagon. And maybe when you send it somewhere else, the Aron won't be so angry or won't be so powerful, and they'll be okay. Gat Yisov Aron Elohei Yisrael, Vayasebu Ot Aron Elohei Yisrael. So they moved it to Gat. Vahi Achrei Sabu Oto. So after they moved it, Vati Yad Adonai Ba'ir Mihuma Gdola Meod. God's hand was very strong in the city of Gat, with a great confusion. Vayachad Anshei Ha'ir Mikaton V'Yad Gadol. And he smote all the people in the city, from small to large, from young to old, vayisatrulahem again tchorim, and they were affected or afflicted by these tchorim. Vayisatru, maybe from the word, read it with a samach, something that was secretive. They were meaning in a secret place. Vayishalchu et Aron al ha'Elohim akron. So the next thing they did is they didn't take counsel anymore. People in Gat just sent it to the next town. They sent it to Akron. And here there's no more reason to think that Akron's going to be any better off. So the people in Akron are not patient. In Gat, they were patient because they thought, all right, maybe it was only powerful in Ashdod. But now that in Gat it affected, everybody knows, you get the Aron near you, you're in trouble. The Aron is bad news. So they, as soon as it came there, Vayizaku Akronin lemor, hey, sabo elai t'aron la Yisrael, amiteni v'etami. The people in Akron said, they've brought the Aron here to kill me and my people. In other words, they didn't wait for anything to happen. So Vayishluchu Vayasfut Kol Sanei Flishtim, they gathered again the council of the Sranim. Vayimru Shalchu Et Aron Elohei Yisrael V'yashov Limkomo. Send it back to its place. V'loyamit Oti V'etami. And so it shouldn't kill me or my people. K'aitam U'mat Mavet B'chol Ha'ir Kavdami Od Yad Ha'Elohim Sham. Because there was a tremendous confusion throughout the city. Very, very powerful. God's hand was there. So they didn't know what to do. The people who didn't die, and there's a lot of them died. The ones who didn't die were afflicted by, again, either hemorrhoids or the plague. And the cries of the pain came up to heaven, not indicating necessarily any tefillah, but just that their cries were heard because they were all suffering. Now, there's two pieces to look at here. One of them we're going to leave for the next parak because it's going to happen in a much less comfortable setting for us. And that is that the Aron's presence is going to be not one of spiritual elevation and excitement, but rather of danger and of death. Not to exclude the spiritual elevation, but in this context, all we hear about is the danger. But the phenomenon I want to look at here is the phenomenon of kriyuchtiv. Three times in this passage you have the word apolim, describing the plague, and it's substituted with the word tchorim. And in your Tanakh, if you have the text in front of you, you likely have the word tchorim written in with a little asterisk or some mark, and on the side it may say ktiv apolim. Or you may have the opposite. You may have, if you have a Koran Tanakh, it'll say ba'apolim, but it's not vocalized or cantillated. There's no marks there. And on the side or underneath, it'll have the word tchorim with cantillation marks and with vowels. What is this phenomenon? So we are certainly familiar with the phenomenon of kriyuchti. We had it in the last parak when Eli was sitting yad derech mitzapeh, but in the written text it reads yach. Instead of a dalet, it's a chaf sofit. And that kind of kriyuchti, there are discussions as to why such a thing exists. The mainstream approach is that taken by the Radak of David Kimchi for 13th century in France, who suggested that when, and this is in his comments in Sefer Yoshua, that when Bnei Yisrael returned from the exile from Bavel, they found that the manuscripts they had developed some variations, because after all, the text is divine, but the copiers are human, and humans make mistakes. And therefore, here and there, in small, insignificant places, small errors, like substituting a resh and a dalet, or in our case, a dalet and a chaf sofit, letters that look very much alike, or a letter dropping out like a vav, those differences and variations suddenly became manifest. And so he maintains that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah decided to maintain the two most significant texts in such a case, one as the Ktiv, the way it's written, and therefore in a written Tanakh. And for instance, if you have the Sifrei Nach that are written on a cloth, that are written to be read, for the Haftarot to be read from a cloth, they'll be written as the Ktiv. They'll also be written without vowels, and without cantillation marks, and without chapter headings, like a Sefer Torah. That's how it should be written. But the way it should be read would be the more reasonable read of the text. That explains most manifestations of kriyuchtiv. Because kriyuchtiv is almost always a slight change, a missing letter, an added letter, then there's some somewhat strange ones, like whole missing words, or words that are totally omitted, meaning words that are in the written text that we omit, or words that are missing from the written text that we say, and both of those exist in Megillat Rut. But here we have a whole different ball of wax, which is a word which is substituted with a word that doesn't look anything like it. It's very hard to suppose that some scribe, was copying, and every time he got to Apolim, he made the same mistake of writing Tchorim. They're different letters. And so here we come to a different phenomenon. And this is a phenomenon that the Gemara in Nedarim, Daf Lamed Zayin, refers to as Tikkun Sofrim. Tikkun Sofrim, which literally means the adjustments of the scribes, refers to particular texts in which the way that the text is originally presented is fixed, if you will, or repaired in such a way that it is more seemly. The examples given in the Gemara are examples of where the text itself corrected itself. And Rashi points this out about Tikkun Sofrim, like Achar Ta'avoru, that Hashem left his presence instead of, etc., things of that sort, where it really wouldn't be seemly to write it the way that it was originally intended to be written, and so it's written in a way that's more respectful, generally respectful towards God. That's one form of Tikkun Sofrim. However, we also have several texts in which the original expression of the text is really vulgar, and is really upsetting, and is very hurtful. And therefore, the written text remains what the written text is, but the way that it's read publicly is a little softer. And we have two examples of this phenomenon, including ours, in the Torah. And they appear right near each other in Dvarim Chaf Chet, in the terrible Tochacha, the terrible curse, what will happen if we do not follow the mitzvot, that appears in the middle of Parshat Ki Tavo, towards the end of Parshat Ki Tavo. And in that case, Hashem is going to strike you ba'apolim, and we read ba'tchorim. And another example, and this will illustrate it perhaps, is Isha te'ares, v'ish acher yishkavena. You will betroth a woman, and another man will lay with her. However, the written text is Ish acher yishgalena, which is a far more vulgar word for having relations. And so even though it's written yishgalena, we don't read it that way out loud. When we're reading from the Torah, we read yishkavena to kind of soften the blow. In the same way here, we have apolim, which is a terrible, terrible plague. So the text softens it up with the word tchorim, which is a hemorrhoid, which is certainly nothing to dance about, but is far less severe than that. What's a little curious is that when we look in the next parak, we'll see tchorim written once as the written version and the read version, without apolim, which raises some questions. And But nonetheless, that seems to be the way that we read it here. How do we know, parenthetically, that apolim refers to some sort of a plague? Because, as we will see in the next parak, one of the gifts that the Plishtim suggest sending back with the Aron, a gift to be brought to God, is mice. And because mice, as we know, are carriers of the plague. So evidently they understood that mice are very close to this God of Israel, because you see the plague that he sent was a plague that was propagated by mice. In any case, over the course of the last half hour, we've studied a very short parak, but we've seen two very huge issues. One of them, the issue is of polemic literature in Tanakh, with several examples, and one being right here with the way that the worship of Dagon is vilified, but is also ridiculed. And the second is the phenomenon of kriuchtiv, as it happens when there are slight variations, the Radak's approach, which is that it is simply a scribal error, and when there are larger differences, which happens infrequently in Tanakh, but it happens three times in our parak, and that is something that we refer to as tikkun sofrim, or perhaps itur sofrim, which is to make the message a little bit less upsetting for the public reading. As you see, this same change takes place twice more in the next parak, but we will at that point just glide through it as we've covered it fairly fully in this shiur. We'll see you next time on OU.org and at Shalom.com, and as we continue our study of Sefer Shmuel and follow the Aron as it ultimately will make its way back home.